Well, hello again, everybody. This is Turd, and this is another edition of the TF Metals Report podcast. Today's guest is economist, journalist, blog writer.
Don't call me an economist. An economist, that's like an insult. That's like, you know, saying something about my mother.
I apologize. How about international international sex
man
symbol?
Man of mystery. Yes, I like that.
You like that? Yeah, and man of mystery.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Gonzalo Lira you hear on the other end.
Thanks for having me on, TF. I mean, it's a pleasure being on this podcast. And I think that it's safe to say that, you know, I think that this is a great thing that you're starting out. And it's a pleasure being on one of your early shows. And I hope that this is a continuing thing. So thank you.
Well, my pleasure. Most of my turdites and I got to know each other through Zero Hedge, and so I assume there are a lot of folks that are listening to this that already are familiar with your work, Gonzalo. And I wanted to stress as we get started the value of this new venture that you have begun. I used to read your work on Zero Hedge, and then I followed you on Blogspot. But I know that a few months back you created your new organization called the Strategic Planning Group, which is a subscription-based service. So maybe if you could take a second as we begin to tell the turdites about it and what the cost is and how it works.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. It's called, like you said, the Strategic Planning Group. The address is lirasspg.com. Strategic Planning Group, lirasspg.com. And the idea is basically to gameplay extreme black swan scenarios that might happen. Now, the ones that we've outlined so far are, for instance, what happens if there is hyperinflation in America? And it's a complete analysis of what to do in that set of circumstances.
Yes.
What happens if the dollar becomes, you know, what happens if and maybe when the dollar goes down the tubes? And goes down the tubes, you know, like kind of like a Weimar kind of thing, you know. Basically, if what happened in 1980 had not been purged by the Fed, which I think that is increasingly likely, and the dollar had just, you know, devalued and gone to outer space. Then another one that we've been game playing this back in June. It's called, you know, when the euro breaks. And back in June, you know, I was arguing, you know, well, what happens if one of the small countries exits the euro, and of course, the small country doesn't disappear off the face of the planet. It muddles along with a new currency and devalues and all the rest of it. And what would a bigger country, like, say, Italy or Spain, do? And so we gameplayed that scenario, and of course, that is proving to be a very prescient scenario, because it looks like we're going to have that situation in the very near-term future of one of the big countries, if not both Italy and Spain, exiting the eurozone. And another one that we worked on is something called Exit America. Now, Exit America was sort of controversial. It's basically the idea of what happens if you absolutely positively have to leave the United States because the circumstances of life in America have become intolerable for whatever reason. Okay, I mean, it could be that you yourself get into some kind of legal problem, or maybe there is a systemic crisis or whatever. Whatever is the reason that you need to exit America, we go through the different circumstances and where to go. And of course, in that scenario, what we posited, which I think is very important, is that there is not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. I mean, for instance, you might love the beach. I personally hate the beach. You know, too much sand, too much water, too much heat. I prefer the snow, you know? And so, of course, you know, what's good for you is not good for me, and vice versa, right? I mean, you hate the snow, you know, it's too cold, it's too this, that, the other. So in Exit America, it's basically a way to analyze your particular situation, your particular needs, the reasons you have decided to exit America, and from that, for you to come up with a concrete reason or a concrete method to move out of the United States and where you would go, kind of thing. And that kind of we've also done another one. We're going to have one right now. It's coming up. Well, by the time the show airs, it's airing on Saturday, I understand. It's coming up this Friday, so it'll already be up when this airs. It's called They Came for My 401k. And we have this little drawing of these zombies, you know, coming at us, right? And what it is basically a discussion of what happens if and when the economic situation is such that one's retirement situation is no longer tenable. Now, this is, of course, is a key issue because I don't know about your audience. I know that your audience is very similar to mine in this regard. My audience are people who are, you know, relatively well off, but they're not rich rich.
Right.
They're not $50 million or $2 billion rich. Because when you get beyond, say, $100 million, you know, you lose $20 million, you gain $20 million, it's no big deal. I mean, sure, it's 20% of your net value, but when you get to that level of numbers, of dollars, you know, it doesn't change your standard of living. But the problem is that when you're in the middle range, if you're, you know, with a net worth of $1 million, between $1 million and $5 million, a 20% hit can change things very badly. And here's another thing, of course. If you have a net worth between 500 and $1 million or less, and you're dependent on a pension of some sort, a corporate pension, Social Security, what have you, you know, this can really change your situation if there is a currency event, if there is some kind of bankruptcy of the corporation that is owing you money. And sure, you know, a lot of these corporations have like these insurance policies, and you know, you're not going to lose all of your money, but you're going to take a hit. And of course, if there is inflation, you're going to take the biggest hit of them all. And so in this scenario, they came for my 401k, we discuss what would be the smart plan for the current situation that we are living in. I think that you and I would both agree that we are living in extraordinary times. And we have to face these times fully and look them in the face and realize that we're living in a world historical time, because what has happened is that we have gone on a 30-year credit drunk. You know, ever since 1987, when Alan Greenspan opened all of those liquidity windows to shore up the markets following the 87 panic, we have had subsidized money. And I think that that's the core issue. And you know, I'm going to go off on a rant here, and it's going to last a while. But my sense is all of the problems we have experienced since 1987 up until today are a product of a single decision on the part of the Federal Reserve, which was to put out subsidized money, cheap money, the famous Greenspan put. Now, you have to ask yourself, I mean, I have a lot of problems with standard economic theory. Okay, I don't necessarily agree with, you know, even you know, the issue of supply and demand. I think it's more sophisticated than the standard model will have you believe. But leaving that aside for the time being, let's just assume that everything that we have read in economics is absolutely true, and you know, it's the law of supply and demand and all the rest of it, and the supply curve and the demand curve and so on and so forth, and price elasticity and blah blah blah. Now, if I am providing money into the market at a discounted price, if I am subsidizing that money, that skews the market for money. Is that correct? I mean, money, after all, is just
that
another
is
good. Am I right or wrong? Right. If I were to subsidize, just for the sake of argument, bubblegum. If I, you know, instead of, you know, it costing, you know, 50 cents per stick of gum, I sold it for 10 cents and created this demand for gum at 10 cents. And of course, this demand was untenable in the long run. What would happen? I mean, all these people would be buying bubblegum like crazy, and it would create an unhealthy dependency on the bubblegum. And when the bubblegum became more expensive, you know, what would you have to do? You would have to either create more bubblegum to keep the price low, or everybody would have to take the hit in the higher price. Let's say, because of bubblegum, that there's a fixed amount of supply of bubblegum, right? If, for instance, for 30 years, since 1987 up until today, everybody's getting subsidized bubblegum, right? And then all of a sudden it just becomes untenable and I have to raise the price of bubblegum. And I, of course, I'm the sole supplier of bubblegum. What happens? I lose customers, sure. But, you know, I have a crash in the bubblegum market because all the people who ate the bubblegum, now it's much more expensive, right? What do? I have to either produce more bubblegum or everybody just takes the hit, right? With money, with fiat currency, okay, the exact same thing happened, but with the one key difference. It is fiat currency. Therefore, the Federal Reserve can print more of it. A lot of people are very much opposed to fiat currency. I'm not. I think fiat currency is great.
Right.
So long as it is handled responsibly. Right. I think that exactly. Fiat currency, I've always said, is like a loaded gun. A loaded gun is harmless if it is handled responsibly by an adult with a safety on, you know, like a grown-up. But if you give it to a fool or a child, of course, something terrible is going to happen. Unfortunately, ever since Alan Greenspan took over, he has subsidized money, and because of the subsidy, we have all grown accustomed to cheap money. Based on this cheap money, we had a run-up in the price of assets. It is absurd to think that a three-bedroom house is worth, say, $600,000. That is,
yeah, exactly,
30 times the minimum wage. That doesn't make any sense at all. It makes sense if the house is worth, you know, you know, 10 times the minimum wage. That makes some sense, but 30 times? I mean, you start looking at different asset classes, every asset class, and you start realizing that they have all been bubbles. People say that there have been serial bubbles, but they look at them independently as if they are separate bubbles, each and every one of them. You know, the dot-com bubble, the real estate bubble, this bubble, that bubble. But they all come from the same source, the same hunk of frozen CO2 at the bottom of this lake, if you will, you know, to extend a little metaphor there. You have cheap money that's been bubbling forth and creating these asset bubbles. Now, starting in 2008, these asset bubbles essentially collapsed, and what we had was a deflationary run on the bank, okay? Just as the same, remember, I was telling you about the issue of bubblegum. When that price subsidy can no longer be continued and you have a fixed supply of bubblegum, what happens? There's a big old crash. That's what happened in 2008. But a fiat currency can be printed up. You can print up the fiat currency, and you can just keep on printing, and which is exactly what the Federal Reserve has been doing. They have printed up between the immediate QE that they implemented following the 2008 crisis, which was what they expanded their balance sheet by something like $1.5 trillion, then the additional $600 billion that they added for QE2. You throw in QE Light, which, you know, technically it's not actually money printing, QE Light, when they use the exceedance from all these toxic assets to buy up treasury bonds. But you can think of them as indirectly money printing. I mean, it depends how you argue it, but that's immaterial. At the bottom, at the end of the day, you have roughly $2.5 trillion that have been printed up since September of 2008 up until today. And now you have Treasury is going to go out, and they just announced it today. They're going to go out and buy $400 billion worth of long-term Treasury bonds, and they're going to sell $400 billion of short-terms. But basically, that's, you know, just going to flatten the yield curve and keep interest rates low. All of that they're trying to do is keep interest rates low and print more money because they are trying to recapture something that was not organic. It was not real. It was subsidized money. Yeah. And so what you have now is that you are seeing commodities that have gone up in price up until recently. Now, copper is starting to take a dive. I follow copper very, very closely, of course, because you know I live in Chile, and Chile is the number one world's exporter of copper. And because of this, the Chilean economy is very contingent on the price of copper. Roughly 50% of its exports, of its net exports, come from copper. And so I have seen how copper is going down, and they always say that copper is the only metal that has a PhD in economics. Well, what seems increasingly clear is that copper is going down because what has happened is that there was a speculative run between 2008 and 2011, and that was based on the notion that there was going to be a resurgence of the economy and therefore piling into commodities in order to avert this stealth devaluation that we've been experiencing over the last 3 years, and going into a commodity would be the smart move. But the problem is we are seeing with the output figures, industrial output figures, and all the rest of it coming from China, Europe, the United States, we are seeing that we are not going to have a recovery, and we're realizing it's not even a double dip. We never got out of the dip. We had a little speed bump on the way down, but we're still going down. We are in a depression. Now the point becomes, we are going to see more devaluation of the currency and a generalized devaluation. I mean, that's what basically happened 10 days ago. The four major central banks, the B of E, the Federal Reserve, the ECB, the European Central Bank, and the Swiss National Bank, all essentially agreed to a coordinated devaluation of their currencies. Now, who stands to benefit? The only one who stands to benefit are people holding precious metals. Now, of course, the SNB was the first one that went out there and just sold a truckload of gold contracts in order to not make it so obvious. When they fixed the price of the Swiss francs, when they devalued by 10% and fixed it at 1.2 Swiss francs per euro, I mean, they went out, and everybody knows this, there's been Zero Hedge, everybody's talked about this. They went out and sold a bunch of gold contracts.
Right.
Just to stabilize the price of gold, of course, which was the sensible and reasonable thing to do. But the point is, this is just a speed bump. And to finish off this rant, you know, Turd, that I am not a gold bug. A lot of people are gold bugs. I am not. A lot of people, it seems to me, and all due respect to them, seem to be more interested in selling gold than, you know, paying attention to what's going on. They're just trying to sell, and that's fine. My own sense about precious metals is I could care less. And as I've said before, I'm all in favor of a fiat currency. But what I'm saying is that now, in this set of circumstances that we have, due to the conditions that we currently have and the policy responses that are the only policy responses available to the four major central banks, the only thing they can do is devalue. And they have to continue devaluing. And that's why it seems to me, and you can argue this with me, and I'd be delighted to talk about it, that the smart thing to do is to buy precious metals, because they are the only thing that are going to continue to go up and hold capital value while the economy rebalances at this more inexpensive devalued currency that we are going to be seeing all around the world.
Hey, that was a good one.
Here endeth my rant.
Thank you all.
I
was gone for about 10 minutes there, Gonzalo. I had to get up and make a few phone calls, but no, just kidding. From that point, I often, when people email me or come up to me on the street and say, "Turd, what do you think of this?" The question is, why do I own gold? Why would I buy? Why do I even want own gold or silver? And as it relates to gold, gold is a store of wealth. In that, in my opinion, the world is shifting paradigms in a sense. We are changing from this current currency regime into something. We can all speculate as to what that something may be 5 years, 10 years from now. But I would think we will revert to some type of sound money structure, not a fully asset-backed currency, and maybe not even a global regime. It may be a system of regional reserve currencies. But nonetheless, as a practical matter, I can see where someone would take their fiat today and buy gold or silver to retain, so that you might retain the fiat value of that, in that in the end, when there is now some type of new money structure, you can then convert your metal back into whatever that new money is. That's kind of how I've, on a broad brush, seen that playing out. I mean, is that consistent with what you're saying there? Yeah, that's the thing.
Well, I don't know what's going to happen on the other side of this. I mean, I could argue all sorts of different scenarios. And what you're saying, for instance, is within the realms of the possible, of course. But it's sort of like, you know, how can I put it? You know, right now they're playing the
football.
What sport is currently playing?
Like baseball.
Baseball, I guess. Yeah, okay, football. Yeah, football, baseball. You know, okay. So the 2011-2012 football season is just underway. You know, and we have X number of teams that are, you know, the big favorites. The issue becomes, you know, in the 2013-2014 season, who?
Right.
Or which team is going to be the favorite team?
Just guessing. Jeez,
I don't know. I mean, you know, I could guess maybe, you know, the Packers or the Steelers or who knows. Just say tossing names out. Because it's too far ahead in the future. We don't know a whole host of things that are going to happen between now and the 2013-2014 season. 2013 and 14 aren't that far away. But, you know, my own sense is that fiat currency is never really going to disappear. Because, in point of fact, it has been extraordinarily successful. All this talk about, you know, how fiat currency is evil and all the rest of it, I don't quite understand it, to tell you the truth. I mean, you have to look at the practical aspects. I mean, everybody says that, 1913 was the worst year in the world, you know, because the central bank, the Federal Reserve was created. And it has all been downhill from then, you know. Since 1913, the United States has been going straight to hell. And my response to that is, you know, it's taken quite a while to get to hell. I mean, what, 98 years so far?
We're close.
And we're still not there yet. I mean, we're you know, inching closer.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean,
most
if you're
going
to go to hell, you have to go to hell in a reasonable time frame. If you're telling me that it takes a century to get to hell, you know, I'm not convinced, frankly, you know. So my sense is that a fiat currency, again, as I've said this innumerable times, if it is handled responsibly, you're all good. Okay. My big hero, of course, is Paul Volcker. I've written about him. I mean, geez, I wrote about him like a 15-year-old girl writing about, you know, her favorite rock star.
You're Justin Bieber.
Yeah, totally. You know, he's Yes, I'm a 15-year-old girl, and he's Justin
Bieber.
Dreamy. Look at him.
Yeah, he's,
doesn't
he's
he
really
look like
dreamy.
Justin Bieber? I mean, all that hair. Yeah. Well, my sense, the reason I have such enormous admiration for Tall Paul, of course, is because at the time, in 1980, he did what had to be done in order to save the currency
right.
and for the long-term health of the U.S. economy. He killed inflation. And, of course, it was incredibly difficult on a political level. I mean, you saw that famous cover of Time magazine where he's, like, smoking a cigar, and it's like a growing red ember, and he looks like Darth Vader, right? And of course, they picked that
right.
shot deliberately to make him look like Darth Vader. He was this evil bastard who was screwing the U.S. economy. But in the long run, you know, sure, we had for a while we had 23% mortgage rates, which is sort of like absurd, right? But in the long run, it was for the benefit of the nation. It was for the benefit of the U.S. economy. So my sense is that it doesn't matter where the medicine comes from. It doesn't matter if it's a lefty or a righty or a centrist or whomever. It could be a Martian for all I care. My sense is that you want to maintain a fiat currency because a fiat currency allows an economy to expand in a way that a fixed currency,
right.
that is an asset-backed currency, a gold standard currency, does not allow. Because inflation, the standard model of economics seems to be correct when it says that inflation allows for an economy
right.
to grow beyond its means, to expand beyond, you know, the realm of its limits. And so I'm totally in favor of that. As a practical matter, because we want an expanding economy. My problem, of course, is irresponsibility. And it seems to me that the people running the shop, you know, the clowns running the circus, you know, they're fools. They're creating, you know, a nightmare for us. And it breaks my heart, you know. It breaks my heart because these people did not do what had to be done early on. In 1991, 1995, you know, all these little mini recessions, and there was this
right.
great moderation. Instead of purging the system of this exceedent capacity in order to reset the economy, I mean, it's becoming increasingly clear that the effort to ameliorate every little recession added to the effect until we had this one great big depression that we're currently living in. And let's make no mistake, we are living in a depression. We all know this. But yeah. So what do you think of this announcement, by the way? The whole Fed thing on $400 billion for longs against $400 billion for shorts.
I'm going to get back to that in a second, Gonzalo, but I want to clear up one thing for all my turdites because I've added a lot of yeses and a huhs, and I think there's – and those mm-hmm. are genuine, and that I think a lot of people think that I am a mm-hmm. sound money return to the gold standard type, and I don't have an advanced degree in economics, but that was my undergraduate degree. And so I do understand the positives of a fiat money system, in that a sound money system is almost too much like a zero-sum game. And you need to have
right.
this
yes.
growth to be able to share prosperity, because if only one or two or three major nations are succeeding and growing based off of the zero-sum game, then that leaves a lot of people in the dark, and that leads to global instability,
yeah.
at least you would think it would. So I'm with you with that.
Yes.
And again, yes, we've unfortunately done this in an environment where it's been politically expedient to spend more than you take in. And that's where we've gotten into trouble. And where
yes.
I would then – and I do want to get back to what happened today, but where I wanted to ask you is the problem that I see us in now is really almost as simple as that law of compounding interest, in that, you know, you never want to get heavily in debt on your credit card because it starts to compound. The interest compounds faster than you can earn money to pay it off. And that's where we are now.
Yeah.
And yeah. at $1.6, $1.8 trillion a year in new debt, there is no possibility that rates can be allowed to rise, because it would stifle any economic growth that even is potentially out there, thereby destroying tax revenue even more and quickening the plunge.
Yeah.
And so to that end, we have
yeah.
this Operation Twist, I guess is what they're calling it today. I'm not sure what to make of it, Gonzalo. I see it as the Fed, you know, if you're a guy like me and you watch these things every day, the movements of all these different commodities and indices, you see it can't be coincidence that every time the dollar index gets down towards critical support, all of a sudden the headlines get drummed up that there's all this great risk in the world again. So here we go. The dollar index, is bouncing along critical support, and all of a sudden, you know, the headlines out of Europe are all scary again. So the Fed uses, or at least would seem to be the case, that the Fed uses this panicked environment to find buyers for these short-term securities that they wish to sell. Thereby, what they're doing is repatriating $400 billion from overseas or from the banking committee from the banking cartel or wherever whoever's going to be buying which the Fed is selling on the short end. And then the Fed is going to take that $400 billion and buy long-term government bonds. Is that really $400 billion new dollars? Like if they were just printing it from whole cloth like they were 6 months ago? No, but is it still $400 billion taking that's now getting into circulation to fund the federal government? Yes. I mean, is that consistent? I mean, is that logical? Yeah. Okay.
No, you're being completely logical. Something that you said at the beginning, which I think is the key issue, of course, is the issue that interest compounds. And so you can easily reach a point whereby the interest is accruing faster than you can earn money to pay it off. And you become a slave to the debt, and it becomes a debt spiral. And you know, you're screwed, basically. There are two ways that you can get out of that, or three ways. You can either raise more money, or you can cut spending, or you can devalue the currency. Okay, those are the essentially, and of course, default. Default is the fourth way.
De jure, devaluing, or whatever the right legal term is. But yes, you can default by devaluing in a sense.
Yeah. Now, I've always been of the notion that the United States will never default, even though they seemingly came close, but they will actually never default on their debt, on treasury debt. Okay, mm-hmm. Because there's just too much political on both sides of the aisle, just too much political freak out over the issue. I mean, one thing is, you know, a government shutdown, you know, sure. But – and also remember the last game of chicken that they played up in Congress, right? At the end of the day, they were never going to default. They would start shutting down services and maybe even start shutting out, you know, veterans benefits and even Social Security before they'd get around to shutting off the money spigot on treasuries, because they can't. The Treasury Department knows that the Treasury bills and bonds and notes have to be paid up because they need it for funding, and it's just, you know, can't do it. But anyway, the current situation that we find ourselves in with insofar as the American government is concerned is exactly that. We are in a debt spiral, and we have a federal government deficit which is 10% of GDP, and it is going to continue to be 10% of GDP for as far as the eye can see. I mean, the figures I have is that it's going to be at least until fiscal year 2014 before it starts really shrinking. So if you're saying that you're going to have a federal government deficit of 10% up until the next 3-4 years, it's systemic. So the issue becomes – So the only way to go is devaluation. That's the only way open for the people who are in positions of policy control, because it's the easiest. Because a default can't be done. Raising taxes, politically, it cannot be done. Cutting spending, politically, cannot be done. The only way to do it is to devalue. Now, who gets hurt by a devaluation? Right. People who live on fixed incomes. You know, Social Security recipients, they're going to take the hit, a huge hit, retirees. And so that's why, you know, this is a roundabout way of saying, that's why I recognize that this scenario that I'm doing at lirasbg.com is so important, because the only way out of this hole is for the government to start devaluing the dollar. The Fed has to do it.
They can't,
because there's no
other
solution other
than that. And Gonzalo, I would even say,
no.
I mean, how do you characterize default? Is it, you give me, I buy a bond for $1,000 and you give me nothing back? Or is default that you give me, okay, so then.
No, it would be a haircut.
How do you
80%.
Get S&P or Moody's or Fitch to then score things on a dynamic basis? Because yes, I may give you back the same $1,000, but in purchasing power, it's only worth $500. So have you defaulted in that regard?
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
Officially, you haven't. In fact, you have. But no one will. But that would never be acknowledged.
Yeah. No, of course not. I mean, look, in Chile, we have a unit called Unidad de Fomento. Okay. Yeah. It means literally a unit of growth. Okay. Because this was implemented in the 60s in Chile, in the early mid 60s, I believe. Because what happened is that Chile, as a growing economy, had a problem with inflation. And, you know, the various left-wing governments would constantly print. And so it became a problem insofar as to value property and different things and debts. It was impossible to have long-term debt because of this constant devaluation or inflation or what have you. So they created the unit of growth, the Unidad de Fomento. And it is set by the central bank. And it is indexed to inflation, to a basket of goods and services, and a very transparent basket of goods and services. The whole basket is published on Chilean Central Bank website and all the rest of it. Now, the reason I'm mentioning is that it was a very, very good invention because it allowed the currency, the inflation rises and falls, but it doesn't matter. Like in the case of my apartment, I purchased my apartment for an X number of units of growth. 8,000 to be precise. I purchased it back in 2002. Now, if I were to sell it today, I would advertise it as being worth 8,000 UFs, these units of growth, unidades de fomento. And that's how it would be priced. Now, of course, in terms of actual pesos, there are a lot more. That's about, you know, in 10 years, it's been roughly 30% more. There's been, you know, about roughly 30% inflation since then until now, which is pretty good for a Latin American country, which has had a fairly stable monetary policy. But if you think about it, if you have, you know, about 3% inflation every year in 10 years, sure, that's what you get, right? And so what we have is this system, and it maintains the value, the purchasing power, so you know what an asset is worth. But in the United States, this is not the case. Before the Federal Reserve, the United States did have a unit of growth, and it was called gold and silver. Gold bullion and silver bullion were considered to be the objective measures of value because there were so many devaluations and depreciations before 1913. After 1913, that was not the case. And, you know, little by little, well, there was that big devaluation in 1933. And at the end, you know, Nixon went off the gold standard in, what was it, 73 or 71? I always – 71. But the point is, see – today, we don't have that objective unit of value. We don't have – we have gold, but it's trading. It's not
–
we don't have the dollar fixed to the gold standard. So, yeah, I know. No, I don't want to touch a sore spot. But my point is this. Since officially we do not have that kind of clear, established objective unit of value, it's all subjective.
Right.
It's all relative one to the other. You know, the gold, the dollar index, what is it? It's not based on gold. Mm-hmm. It's based on other currencies. It's a relative valuation. So my point is, we will realize that we have devalued when it's all over. And we are seeing this with gold over the last 3 years. It's gone up from what? From 700 and – I purchased gold personally in January of 2009 at 748. And I'm a very happy camper because now, even though it's gone down a bit, it's at 1780. You know, I've basically made $1,000 per ounce since then, you know, in 3 years. Now, that's insane.
That's a lot.
That's 130% profit in 3 years. But what does that really tell you? It tells you that the currency has been devaluing along the way. And that's what we have. Now, when you have a devalued currency, you're able to pay the debts. And so on an accounting level, you don't have defaults, you don't have bankruptcies. But what happens, of course, is that the people who depend on fixed payments of X number of dollars, they are earning less, they are hurting more. And so that's why it seems to me that every retiree in the country, and this is what I'm writing about at lirasbg.com, every retiree in the country has to take a good hard look at the current economic situation and realize if I stick to this fixed income, I'm dead, because eventually when I'm retired, when I'm 75 years old, the income I am going to be getting is going to be the equivalent today of $200, and you cannot live on $200.
Well, and that actually dovetails into one of your other scenarios, and I want to ask you a few more questions, being very generous with your time, and I know all the turdites, and I appreciate it. That first scenario on your site, the hyperinflation scenario, which is, of course, brought about by this currency debasement primarily. Now, that number gets thrown about, and people are running around reading books about the Weimar Republic and Zimbabwe other hyperinflationary events in the past.
Right.
When you discuss it, when you discuss it with your clients, what type of scenarios are you looking for? Well,
what do you mean specifically?
Of an inflationary, and is it an inflationary event or is it a series of events? Is it something where over time you'll see a gallon of milk go from $3 US to $10 US, or is it something that happens over a period of weeks?
Well, it's certainly not overnight. Okay, it'll seem overnight, but you know it happens over a period of weeks and months. But we don't realize it as it's going, as it's happening. It's like a boiling a frog. You know, put a frog in cold water and start turning up the heat. The frog is going to die. Toss the frog into boiling water and it'll jump right out. You know, insofar as inflation of the dollar is concerned, I do not see. How can I put it? I do not see it happening like we wake up one day and everything's double in price. It's not going to happen, okay? It's going to be a slow, drawn-out affair. It's sort of like gold, okay? The reason I'm bringing up gold is because it has risen to an extraordinary degree, but it hasn't seemed gradual. Like that cataclysmic. Yeah. It's been, you know, just going up. Yeah. You know, it's boiling the frog slowly, right? That's what it seems to me is going to be happening with the dollar. It's going to be toast, but slowly. And so you won't really notice it. Or if you do notice it, it won't be a big deal. A lot of people are under the mistaken impression that there are certain asset classes that elude high inflation. Forget about hyperinflation. A lot of people say, oh, Lira, you're out of your mind insofar as hyperinflation. But they say, well, you know, maybe high inflation or debasement of the currency due to the devaluation that the Fed is carrying out. Okay, fine. Let's take that much more cautious, less hyperbolic term. Let's call it just a prolonged and steady devaluation of the dollar as opposed to calling it hyperinflation. Let's just for the sake of argument, okay? A lot of people think or are under the impression that certain asset classes like real estate, like equities, will walk away scot-free from that kind of devaluation. Now, if you look at it from a strictly purchasing power perspective, inflation, devaluation, it's the same thing. Look at what happened between January of 1979 and January of 1983. The period of most intense inflation in American history since the Civil War.
Called your friend Tall Paul into action.
Well, what happened? What happened to equities? Right. They were flat. They were flat in a period that experienced double-digit inflation for 3 years running. Now, what does that tell you? What?
They were not an inflation hedge.
Stocks went down that amount. Yeah. I mean, no, they were not. Yeah. Ditto with real estate. Real estate, in fact, it was worse. It started going down because the cost of credit, that's something else that economics as a discipline has not been able to figure out how to integrate, it seems to me, the notion of credit and how it affects asset classes. Credit affects asset class prices because if credit is cheap, those assets rise in nominal value because that cheap and available credit creates its own inflation in that particular asset class, which is exactly what we saw in real estate. Now, if you have a high inflation or a devaluing currency, of course credit is going to become expensive. And once it becomes expensive, it's not that the price of those assets, real estate, maintains steady nominally or rises, much less rises with the rate of inflation. In fact, it starts nominally to go down. And in point of fact, back in September and October, I wrote about of last year, I wrote about this specific issue. I ought to do an update about it because I analyzed, you know, the price of properties, of real estate, commercial and residential during that period, and they went down in terms of their key indices between January of 79 and January of 83 during the period of rampant inflation, because that's what happens to real estate. It goes down nominally, okay? In nominal terms, during a period of high inflation, because credit, since it becomes so much more expensive, it becomes reduced because fewer people are taking out loans. Okay, so this is the situation that we're going to be finding ourselves. We're not going to have hedges for inflation in the shape of real estate or equities.
I know what we're
and
left
forget
with.
About bonds. Okay, the only thing that's going to be a hedge against. Yes, and the thing is, one of the things that I've been busting my head about. You know that I'm not a gold bug. You know I'm not interested in precious metals per se. I have been busting my head trying to figure out some other asset class that could act as a substitute for gold in the sense of being a safe haven for capital, a place where I could put my capital and be sure that I'm not going to lose the value of that capital. And I don't know about you, but I've yet to figure out any other asset class that can do what precious metals can do insofar as protecting capital from
I've been
depreciating
a lot
currency.
Of fiat in
I mean,
California
can you think of anything?
Cabernet, but that seems to be that's been depreciating as well.
Yeah, but the problem
yes,
is that you drink it.
That.
You drink it.
And Mrs. Ferguson appreciates that investment, though. But no, you're absolutely right. And you run the risk of being too smart by half. You know, by saying, well, I'm going to show everybody and I'm not going to, it's not gold, it's this. When instead it truly is what has been universally revered as money and store of value for centuries. One more topic I wanted to get your perspective on, Gonzalo, because I respect your opinion in this and you're certainly more studied at this and have looked at this a lot more extensively than I have. But scenario number three, and was a topic of a couple of conference calls that you had for your subscribers as well, and that is when the euro breaks, not if the euro breaks, when the euro breaks. It was created, and when it was created, people thought this is never going to work, and it is now all of that is coming to fruition. How do you see it playing out? Some people think it's going to you get a Nordic euro, and you'll let the everybody else break off and do their own thing? Or how do you envision what will be the scenario that will lead up to that final straw on the camel's back, and then what happens after that? What do you think?
Well, you have to go back to why the euro was created in the first place. And the reason the euro was created in the first place, of course, was to make sure that Germany and France were so united economically that they never think to go to war.
We got to do it
now,
again
of course, think about it. And we've had 65 years of peace on the European peninsula, but we have to understand that the 65 years before that, you know, we had three wars between France and Germany, the Franco-Prussian War, World War I, and World War II. Now, the issue is not if these two countries will have another war. In a very real sense, it's almost when, because they hate each other. They just don't like each other, you know, and that's life, and we don't have to go into the reasons why. But of course, if you have commercial interests with somebody, it doesn't matter how much you despise them. If you do have commercial interest with them, you're going to work with them, and you're going to try to come to sensible solutions. And that is what has happened,
mutually
you know, between 45 and 2011. Now, yeah, exactly. Now, what we need to make sure is, or what we want, is for France and Germany to continue to be unified economically. Because that will ensure the peace, and that is something that, of course, we all want. The day that France and Germany go their separate ways economically, it just becomes the start of the countdown to another war. Now, of course, that war will probably not happen in our lifetimes and maybe even our children's lifetimes. But grandchildren, definitely, because they've been fighting each other since the Roman times, okay, since they were all, you know, a bunch of barbarian hordes. So what we want is to keep the euro. It is not a bad thing per se. And insofar as it unites Germany and France and along the way Holland and Austria and the Benelux countries, great. Now, the best thing they could do is to allow the weaker economies, essentially the pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain, to exit the euro, go back to their old currency, devalue, renegotiate, and start over. Because they are simply weaker economies that went on a credit drunk and they became overextended because they had cheap debt because they were basically using the German and French credit cards. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it was implicitly assumed that all euro countries' bonds were backed by the whole eurozone. And now we're realizing that that's not quite the case. So let those countries go back to their original currency. Let them devalue. Let them rebuild like Iceland did. Iceland is doing very, very well. 3 years after their major crisis, they devalued, you know, they took the hit and it hurt like hell, but they're back and roaring along and better than ever and good for them. See, you know, Mike Tyson had an old saying, everybody's got a plan until they get hit. If you take a hit, I mean, a lot of times you're more afraid of actually getting hit in the face. You think, oh my God, it's going to hurt so bad. Oh, please, no, 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 no. And you go through all sorts of compromises, all sorts of negotiations to not get hit. And it's worse than if you just gone forward and just taken your lumps and that's that, right? I mean, we all know this. Well, let's hope that they do. Because if these stupid, irresponsible countries wind up dragging down France and Germany and dragging them to break up the euro, then that's a real tragedy because those two countries will eventually go to war. Not now, not next year, not next decade, but eventually. We need those two countries to be unified, so intertwined economically, financially, that they will never consider seriously going to war over anything. Okay? That's the number one priority. All the other countries are just along for the ride. But the problem is that these countries that are along for the ride are pulling down France and Germany. Okay? They are creating incredible stresses in the relationship between France and Germany. And so far, you know, Sarkozy and Merkel have been able to sort of like, you know, work together.
Right.
But they got to cut these weak countries loose. And I'm talking Italy and Spain. They got to go. They got to go back to their old currency. They have to do that. The sooner the better, because the longer it takes, the more stress on the Franco-German relationship. And it could conceivably be that these countries break apart from one another. Remember, at the end of the day, the Germans are very, very possessive about the euro. There is a reason that the European Central Bank is in Frankfurt. It's not in Brussels. The Germans feel that the euro is their currency. They're not going to let it go down the tubes. And they will more likely cut off France than the Germans exit the euro.
In Italy, about 60%. That's my sense. In Italy's GDP, about 60% of what Germany's is. So there's Germany. How can they defend the euro?
Yeah, you're exactly right.
Though they might want to with the amount of Italian debt that is held by German banks. So how does that all – I mean, I agree with you. Logically, mm-hmm. that's the only path they can take, but how can they? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do they do it? Well, look. I mean, look at what's going on with Greece. I mean, the Germans are arm-twisting like crazy, and they are getting the concessions from the Greeks. The Greeks just announced that they're going to do a lot of cuts in the pension schemes and all the rest of it. I mean, they're going to take a massive hit, but they're going to stick with the fucking euro. The euro is killing Greece. The Germans, I mean, I don't know if you've ever dealt with Germans. I have. I love them very dearly. Yeah. They're lovely people, but they are completely inflexible. They are, as a nation. Once you tell them that it's one thing, they stick to that. And that's really great. I mean, if you want to build a railroad or something, I mean, hire a German. Yeah, go to war, build a railroad, do anything like really tough and that takes a long time and a lot of grit. You get yourself a German and you're home free, you know? I mean, I hate to point out this obvious fact, you know, and it's not cheerleading for the Nazis,
and
but the fact that there is,
the
Germans fought a two-front war, and they nearly won.
Okay. No, the French?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
That takes a lot. You think the Spanish could have pulled that off? Or the Italians? Come on. You know, they are a nation of gritty people. And they fought a two-front war, and they were getting their country bombed to smithereens, and they still nearly won. You know, I mean, okay, so my point is, the Germans are an inflexible people, and you can say, oh, you're stereotyping, and oh, that's so un-PC, and blah, 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 and that's racial profiling. Fine. I'm a racist pig. But the fact is the Germans are square. They are rigid. they will never allow the euro to be devalued. They had a fit when Jürgen Stark, left the European Central Bank. Jürgen Stark, as you will know, and maybe your audience will recall, was the number two guy at the European Central Bank, and of course the top level German guy at the European Central Bank. And he left because he was completely opposed to this notion of the European Central Bank going out there and purchasing euro bonds in order to shore up these weakened economies, because he was of the opinion that by doing that, it would weaken the euro. The Germans are terrified of having a weak currency, because they are terrified because of historical precedent, the Weimar Republic, that they are very aware of. Every economist in Germany is – they get that with their mother's milk on the one hand. And on the other hand, of course, Germany is a creditor nation. So a creditor nation that has a deflating currency, that is an appreciating currency, of course, is doing better. So they want the euro to get stronger because they become richer. Okay, so it's on the one hand the issue that they want a strong currency because they're terrified of a repeat of Weimar version 2.0. But on the other hand, they're doing it for strictly selfish reasons of like, ooh, you know, with having a devaluing currency, I'm making more money because my savings or my assets that are in euros are going up in value, in purchasing power. So the Germans are doing it for historical reasons and also for selfish reasons. And they are pushing it, and they weigh a lot insofar as monetary policy is concerned.
Right.
And they are getting their way. The euro has to be devalued. That's what has to happen. And these weaker countries have to go. But the Germans, it seems to me, are the ones who are so adamant, so headstrong, pig-headed, if you will, about maintaining a strong euro that I fear, and I hope I'm wrong, I very much hope I'm wrong.
Well, I mean,
but I think that it might be this very pig-headedness on the part of the Germans that will eventually sink the euro.
You can. What is the thing? You're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. It is what it is. Here, I'm just rattling off all the different metaphors that I can come up with, or whatever they are. But I mean, the numbers are where they are, and if devaluation is the only option, and it certainly would appear to be that,
yeah,
then they've got to take their medicine. And like you said, will they actually do it when push comes to shove? There's a fourth one for you.
Yeah, I don't think – I think that when push comes to shove, the Germans are going to be so arrogant that they're going to shove everybody off a cliff. And I think it's going to be – the euro is going to become just a German and Dutch currency.
Well, that's
my sense.
These are all eventualities
I hope I'm wrong, but I think that's why
I wanted to –
that they're going to do that.
You, Gonzalo, because I like what you do with the strategic planning group, in that if you're a turdite – and so you follow and you enjoy the TF Metal site, it's because you're trying to look over the horizon. It's because you're trying to think for yourself that has led you to this search for knowledge and planning.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't just stop at, I'm going to go get myself some gold. And so I envision the folks out there that are visiting my site and others are sitting there trying to do this wargaming in their own minds. But that can only take you so far, and because there are so few people in my own individual circle that I feel the same way. Everybody probably has the same problem. You can't just go up to your brother-in-law, you know, at the Labor Day picnic and say, hey, so what's going to happen when the euro – you know, and so you're left doing this yourself, and that's where I think one of the real values of your site is that you're doing this as well, and so people can go to your site, become a member, and find some like-minded critical thinking to help them plan ahead. So again, you're
thanks. Because you know, one of the things I wanted to point out that's very, very important to me, and I'm sorry for interrupting your very kind words, but I just want to point out something that's very important to me is that, see, I am not selling a quick rich scheme. I am selling not even analysis. I am, of course, but I'm trying to help SPG members think critically about the issues that we are surrounded by. But to think critically in a way that allows them to anticipate where things are going. Wayne Gretzky, the great hockey player, said, I never go to where the puck is. I always go to where the puck is going to be. And that's what I try to help my members understand. It's not an issue like, do these five steps and you'll be rich beyond your wildest dreams. No, it doesn't work that way. I mean, I wish it did. But then, of course, you know, as you obviously know, you know, if it were like five steps and you become rich beyond your wildest dreams, I would be taking them and I wouldn't be telling you about it. You know, I mean, come on. But my, what I am selling, if you will, and because it is, it's a paid membership, and we have to be very clear. What I'm selling is the idea I'm trying to inculcate into people is to think critically about what's going on and to take a step back, because what happens to us, and I think that you'll agree that it happens to you, it certainly does happen to me, is that we become so fixated on the short-term thing. Ooh, what did this guy say today? Ooh, where's gold today? Where's stock XYZ today? We become so fixated on short-termism, on the immediate thing, that we don't take a step back. And in point of fact, the reason the strategic planning group came to be was because I decided that I needed to take a step back insofar as certain issues were concerned, you know, monetary policy, Europe, and some other issues, and really analyze them. And I realized that the best way to do it would be to write it down. And that's how it started. I would deliberately and self-consciously take a step back. And once I started doing this, I realized that other people could get the same insights and benefits that that I'm trying to reach. And of course, we have, like, you know, a few researchers and assistants who help out. I write the whole thing, you know, and people get the benefit of my ranting and raving, but the hard, strong research from a really great team that we have at SPG. And and I think it's something that worthwhile. But like I said, I want to emphasize that it's not a get-rich-quick scheme. It's not three steps to absolutely fabulous wealth. It's more along the lines of, this is what will help you think through these problems and anticipate them. Now, I think that, at the end of the day, like I said in the SPG site, the whole notion of owning gold is not to own gold per se. It's to own gold so that you have preserved your capital for a time when that capital will be able to acquire a lot of goods and assets that will be very valuable in the long term. I mean, my plan is very, very simple. Own gold today, hold on tight, watch as valuable assets, real estate, go down the tubes as the currency depreciates. And once those real estate assets are at a cheap enough price, swap my gold for these real estate assets. Because look, you go through a crisis. We are going through a crisis today. It will end. It will end one way or another in the next 5-10 years. And we're all going to be around there. You know, I mean, some of us are older, some of us not, but the issue is not, you know, we are going to be there. We're going to see it end. And there are going to be opportunities between now and then. The issue becomes preserving your assets so that you can – preserving, rather, your capital so that you can acquire the assets for long-term wealth and stability and security. I mean, look, at the end of the day, people become rich – by doing one of three things: either inventing a better mousetrap, right, that everybody wants to go and buy, by stealing, or by trading. Now, the way that you trade is you have something today and you swap it for something valuable, more valuable, or something that grows in value. And so that's basically what I'm trying to do, and I think that that's what I'm assuming that your objective is as well. It's not the issue of owning gold per se. It's owning gold so that you can preserve your
whether you're
capital
converting it back into for a future whatever the next time currency is, or converting it into
you really take advantage of
land or in anything. But that's exactly right. And
yeah, I mean, my sense. I always follow the Baron Rothschild. You know, he said, when there's blood on the streets, buy property. And he's absolutely right. You know, property, as far as I'm concerned, land,
that
real estate,
again,
that's where it is.
It's
but
not tomorrow,
right now, it's not.
Well, Gonzalo, thank you. This has been extremely valuable.
I want to
endorse what it is that you do and your site, and encourage all of the readers of TF Metals Report to go there and check it out, and strongly consider it. Becoming a paid subscriber. Hopefully we can visit again sometime soon, Gonzalo.
It would be my pleasure. Turd, thank you so much for having me on. And to all the Turdites, rock on. Party on, Wayne. Take care.